This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your blood, sweat, and no tears of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Sure, we're listening to Madonna at the top of the show. Why wouldn't we be listening to Madonna at the top of the show? And if we're listening to Madonna at the top of the show, real podcast heads know it's because Karen Gans is here. Karen Gans, the music editor of the New York Times. Karen, first of all, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, John.
We have been unusually in touch during the last week, closing out a bunch of pieces. And one thing that I have said to you over and again over the last 10 days is that the people are clamoring for Gans. There's notes, there's comments, there's emails. They want to know how your year was. And finally, on your Instagram, which is private, but on your Instagram and also on Twitter, but you posted an albums and songs list, which I'm glad you did, and we'll talk a little bit about it. But you posted a list that reminds me of one of the reasons that you are the most qualified person to do this job, which is your live music best of 2023.
One more time, louder for the bosses in the back.
I'm just saying, if any superior editors, high-level masted people are listening, Karen Gans goes to shows. You can say one thing about Karen Gans. Karen Gans goes to shows. And it got me thinking, last week, I talked to Cesario about the business of live music and how good a year it was for the business of live music 2023. And I looked at your list and I thought we had an opportunity to talk about the other side of live music, which is the experience of going to shows. We haven't really touched on that. And we didn't do much of it over the course of 2023 outside of Eras Tour and a little bit about Renaissance Tour. And truly, of all of us, you went out the most last year. And 2023 was notable because it was the first year, not that shows were back post-pandemic, but the first year that big tours really came back. And so a lot of what you went to were big shows. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about maybe even starting back in 2022, inching back towards going out frequently. Because I know that that's such an important part of you and your consumption and your taste development. Tell me a little bit about what it was like to be without and then to inch it back over the last year and a half.
Now you're making me want to open my 22 list because I think I did shows last year too.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, no, I feel like I'm going to have to look. I mean, the real inching, you'll recall a night we spent together in 2021. In June 2021,
sure do,
when we went to see the Foo Fighters together, which was the first show returning to Madison Square Garden. That was that magical week before Delta, Omicron,
yes.
Delta, I think, mm-hmm. before Delta arrived, when I saw Madonna at LeBain for Pride, and she was inches from my face, and then to Foo Fighters. It's interesting. I mean, I remember John Perella said something to me during the pandemic where he was like, I'm having a harder time seeking out new music because I'm not seeing any openers.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, wow, you still get there for the openers, John. You're the best.
Right. Because I try to target my arrival very carefully to
you know
what I want to see.
Yes, yeah, I know precisely what's going to happen.
Yes.
I mean, but that's part of when you go out professionally for a living. You need to know, you need a little more smoothness with this interaction. You need to know what's happening. But in terms of all the giant pop tours getting back underway, I mean, I think we did talk a lot about Taylor and Beyonce, but they held that torch high and really made it be known that no matter what, live music was happening last year. And I know a lot of artists went on with or without COVID. It was just like, it was really a show must go on kind of mentality. I was happy to jump back into my usual regimen of going to MSG as often as humanly possible for some of these big tours. But they were really good. I'll mention a couple of them.
Yeah, please do.
That really stood out. The Cure was one of the best shows I saw all year.
Before you get into other garden shows, yeah. The Cure is like a great example of a band where it's a heritage band at this point with a huge fan base. I'll be honest and say I didn't necessarily think of it being like top five shows of the year kind of level.
Yeah.
But I remember your reaction after seeing this concert. Talk a little bit about this show and what was so special about it.
I am not a big Cure fan. I mean, it sounds crazy. This was maybe one of my favorite, like, top three shows of the year. Not a big Cure fan. That was not my mode in high school. The Cure, very popular during the 90s when we
that
were.
That is true. Shout out my guy, Aaron, in high school. You dressed as Robert Smith for Halloween, I think our senior year. Killed it. Great.
For Halloween, not on a regular basis. You need more goth friends, John.
That's true.
I had a lot of goth friends and people were really into that band. And it's like, the Cure and the Smiths did not speak to me. I was not particularly mopey in that mode in high school. I wasn't even that angsty. I guess my parents could be listening and disagree, but I think I was pretty even keeled as I am right now, right? Everyone who knows me, very even keeled.
Never. The first thing we say.
Yes, never flashed to anger or rage over anything at all. Never. Just smooth.
Very smooth.
Very smooth. But The Cure, I was hearing great things about this Cure show, and I was like, oh my God, it's sold out in seconds. How am I going to get tickets to this show? And I thought, okay, conventional route for someone like us, we'll find a publicist.
Yeah.
There was no publicist, John.
Yeah.
Robert Smith ran this whole tour pretty much by himself. He was in charge of everything. He was in touch with the fans about their ticket woes. He was negotiating between Ticketmaster and fans regarding fees and ticket availability. Anyway, somebody helped me see the show. Dana Meyerson, shout out. Thank you very much. Helped me get tickets to the show. I could not believe how good it was. Robert Smith sounds better than ever. There is like a very small percentage of artists whose voices are like improving with age. You expect them to have to drop a register or an octave or transpose the music in some way. Absolutely crystalline, beautiful, perfect lyrics, vocals. The band was insanely great, just absolutely on point, one of the best rehearsed bands I've ever seen. And he was such a delight. He was like floating around the stage, just like a benevolent ghost. And he would be on one side and he'd be on the other. I swear he was like Casper-esque in the most positive way. He would just be standing on a part of the stage and just gazing at the audience meaningfully for a long time, like meaningful eye contact. It was like, it was absolutely remarkable. I was sitting in really good seats. I had a friend in pretty poor seats who had the exact same experience. Just for an artist to master the arena show like that, it's a gift and an art unto itself. And not everybody is good at it, as you know. Anyway, mind blowing. So
is there a good Door song that he played that night that we should listen to?
Okay, looking at the set list, which had two encores, this was a 29-song set list. That's something else I completely forgot. This was in June. Much has happened since June. There is traditionally an 11 p.m. curfew at MSG, and as legend has it, if an artist goes past 11 p.m., it costs them something like $1,000 a minute or something like that in the union overtime. He blew past 11 all the way to midnight, and I was like, this guy does not care.
That's Drake money.
The tickets were not even exorbitantly priced where it was just like, it's cake and he doesn't care. He was here for the fans so strong. Anyway, I'm glancing at this 29-song set list. 21 through 29 was just the second encore. This is unbelievable. You know what? Pictures of You was gorgeous. It was number two, and it was so good. Let's hear it.
Let's listen to that.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm David Marchese.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And we're the hosts of The Interview from The New York Times.
David and I have spent our careers interviewing some of the most interesting and influential people in the world.
Which means we know when to ask tough questions and when to just sit back and listen.
And now we've teamed up to have these conversations every week. We'll try to reveal something about the people shaping our world.
And we'll get some great stories from them, too.
It's The Interview from The New York Times. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so you mentioned the garden, your second home, where they should have a memorial bench dedicated to you. What else? What else are we talking about at the garden this year?
Well, you know that they have the facial recognition software at the garden.
They know.
I feel like when I walk in, they're like, good Lord, she's back.
Gans again.
I mean, they should be happy to have
me.
I'm a very loyal patron. Depeche Mode, also unbelievable at the garden. Another show where I could not believe how great he sounded. Especially considering Dave has almost died multiple times, or maybe just once. We did do a story by Alex Papademos last year that was amazing. But yeah, I mean, just crisp, still cool looking, very lithe, very hippie, moving across the stage with remarkable hip action, which we will get to Mick Jagger, but I have things to say about that. Yeah, no, that was an amazing show. I know a lot of people who got to that Depeche Mode tour. It came around twice this year and it was amazing.
SZA.
Oh, SZA. I was with you for SZA.
So SZA, SZA, this is a good example. Again, when we used to cover live concerts as like a significant share of the coverage, a critique that we would, or a comment we'd get externally, and something that I would sometimes think internally is 70, 80, 90% of the time, it's exactly what you think it's going to be. And that's okay. Like sometimes that's good. Sometimes that's fun. Sometimes that's liberating because you're not, and there's no anxiety attached to it, especially at shows at this scale, which have to be replicable night in, night out with minimal changes. You just come to understand that there are certain boundaries that artists are going to play within. The thing that I was most struck by in the SZA show, and I wonder how this struck you, I think of SZA musically, and this is a person who's made one of my favorite albums last year, great music for the last 5 years when she chooses to release music. SZA, I think of as like a pretty internal artist singing about internal struggles and not necessarily presentational in that way. And I was surprised at how up-tempo the music was and how up-tempo the performance was. This wasn't SZA sitting on a stool, singing about heartbreak, drawing people into her, which is one way to do songs like that. It's her saying, I'm playing a room with 17,000, 18,000 people in it. I got to find ways to reach all of them. And I'm going to do that with stage set. And I'm going to do that with dancers. And I'm going to do that by like upping the energy, which is not necessarily what you would think coming off the albums.
She made it a pop spectacle in all of the possible best ways. I thought the set was gorgeous and brilliant. You know, it had that aquatic theme and it had some striking movements, you know, like set pieces with her sitting at the end of the diving board replicating the album cover. There was like a giant anchor. There were just, and then at one point in a very Mariah Carey move, she like sort of rowed across the top of the arena in a rowboat.
Yeah.
Classic. I mean, she played with every single one of the tricks that you can do in an arena. It was like she said, let's just go for it. And it was so successful. I thought she sounded good. It still had an intimacy and an intense emotionality, despite the fact that it was this like kind of a grand scale thing. And we did get two guests that night.
Yes.
We got Cardi, which was such a delight. Even if
they really seem to like each other.
Yes, it was very genuine. And Phoebe Bridgers, they also seemed to genuinely like each other. It was a very warm, woman-powered kind of event. I really enjoyed that show.
Yeah, it was, again, it's nice to, even at this advanced stage of our like music-going experience, it's really always so encouraging to go see a show that's not that ends up being not what you thought it could be. And that's such a relief. I think that arena shows are moving much closer to spectacle, but maybe not to shock. There's something predetermined at the scale of spectacle. Certainly when you think about hip hop shows, think of this about the Drake tour. I'm sure the Travis tour, which I did not get to see, but I'm sure functioned pretty similarly. There are levels of spectacle that people are achieving now. And I don't think that they are quite as novel as they used to be. And artists have to find ways to surprise their fans that they have not previously had.
I've had moments in arenas where I am truly shook. And I'm thinking, actually, the first time I saw 21 Pilots, when I was like, what are they doing? I mean, I didn't understand what was happening. And it was such a bizarre, it was like a mystery, and it was like acrobatics, and it was like a sing-along, and it was fan service, and it was like, it was just a mind-blowing experience. And I actually thought about that a little bit. I caught the 1975 tour towards the end of the year. That did not make my list, unfortunately. And I think it was a slightly neutered version of the tour that they were doing previously before Matty got himself into a bit of trouble by saying and doing too many things. But the set piece of this tour, I went with Scott Heller, our theater editor, because he was intrigued to see the set. And I'm sure many of our listeners have seen this. But anyway, it's like a very Jack Antonoff recreating his bedroom vibe, in that it's like a house and they're playing on the set with working lights and stuff like that. I don't know. It just felt like it didn't meet its potential, that there was so much you could possibly do with that sort of dramatic, just like presentation. And then the music is not my favorite. So I was a little predisposed not to like be in it, but everybody around me was losing their mind. So I was like, obviously this is connecting with a giant swath of the world that's not me, but I don't know. I was let down.
Okay. Let's talk. You saw a lot of rock shows this year.
I did.
Let's talk about some of this stuff.
I'm perusing the list. I mean, on the young end of the scale, we've got 100 Gex, who have my second favorite album of the year. God, that was such a good show.
Yeah. So I also saw one of these shows. We were at the same show, or we?
Oh, we were at the same show.
We were at the same show. Yeah. Yep. Again, a very fun night. I was thinking a lot about Gex last week for some reason, and I was trying to think of a really concise way to explain them to someone who didn't understand or didn't have an entry point. And I really think what it comes down to is Gex gives smart people license to be stupid. And obviously those are false categories, or yada yada, these are terms that don't have meaning, but on a fundamental level, there is something in a liberatory potential. And I think you see that not just in the enthusiasm in the crowd, but also committing to the costumes and so on and so forth. That's a place you go to unravel a little bit.
Our colleague, Lindsay Zolads, I think she captured a lot of that in an essay she wrote for the end of the year, which I don't think she actually spoke about on podcast. So
no,
I will represent
yet.
Her briefly as the editor. But the essay she wrote was about seeing Gex and Blink-182, specifically live. And then she threw in Olivia Rodrigo later, and just talking about the nature of pop punk having a sense of humor and being fun and being a place where you can blow off this energy and just be a fool. But finding that the humor of Blink-182 has aged so terribly poorly. It was never particularly funny in the first place. It's so based on crass. Sorry. Yes. The aliens are listening. I'm sorry, yeah. Tom DeLonge. But that it was always sort of rooted in a us versus them, but like in a, you know, it was just offensive. It was, you know, it was anti-woman. It was homophobic. It had all the crudeness and crassness of a very obnoxious teenage boy, which is also what makes it great. But now that there's a true alternative to that in something like Gex, where it is musically scratches the same itch of being crunchy and poppy and punky at the same time, obviously it's pop punk. I'm reinventing the wheel here. But the thing about the Gex show and the Gex in general is there's a license to stupidity and have fun, but it's on happier terms and an even playing field. It's equal opportunity, way more welcoming. I thought Lindsay's essay completely nailed that. And she also mentioned Olivia Rodrigo's amazing comedic timing and the sense of humor on her record, which is great. We did not see her live this year, really, because she didn't tour. That will be our year-end recap next year. Although I did see her with Sheryl Crow at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which was awesome.
Oh, she performed there?
She did.
What did she do?
She performed with Sheryl, and they did If It Makes You Happy.
Did it slap?
It was great. It was the opening number of the whole show. So I didn't even have time to adjust myself. I was very excited. I knew it was happening at the top of the show, but it was thrilling. Excellent torch passing between those guys.
You mentioned the Rolling Stones earlier, and it's an interesting transition from Gex, a band that I think understands absurdity and weaponizing itself for comedy, and then the Rolling Stones, who I imagine are quite the opposite.
Now, I would disagree with you,
well,
John.
But I'm curious because I have not seen the Rolling Stones since I reviewed, maybe they're at the Prudential Center. This is in your era, or is this before your era of the New York Times?
It might have been before me. I don't remember you reviewing the Rolling Stones.
Okay, so what this was, this is, wow, different era, okay? This is 2012. It's not a review.
Yes.
It's an Artsbeat blog, RIP Artsbeat. We should bring Artsbeat back if anyone's listening, just to handle our news glut. That's one thing. The Artsbeat blog post is titled "Guitar Solos Help Close Rolling Stones Tour." And it is me ranking the guitar solos played by Keith Richards, Ronnie Wood, and also guests Gary Clark Jr. and John Mayer.
That's 2012 in a bottle.
That's real 2012. Anyway, that's available on nytimes.com should anybody be so inclined to revisit that. I have not seen the Rolling Stones since then. Now, I do not find the Rolling Stones historically to be comedic, but I suspected you might.
You have to believe me. So I've seen them twice in the past few years. I saw them at MetLife Stadium, where I could not believe how good they still were at that moment. That was pre-pandemic. So maybe I saw them in 2019. And Mick was in his late 70s. He's in his late 70s. He's approaching 80. He is like unbelievably fluid. He is Gumby-esque still at this age. I'm not lying and I'm not exaggerating. I have so much video from the show to prove it. And he was making jokes at that show about the American Dream Mall. It was before it opened in New Jersey. He was cracking jokes about the mall. He was cracking jokes about having gone to the diner and had Taylor ham that morning, a very Jersey thing to eat. It was hilarious. And then this year, I was really lucky to see them at Racket, which is like a 300, 400 person club that used to be Highland Ballroom, I believe.
Yeah, it's on like 17th or 18th or whatever.
Yeah, on the west side. And he was full of jokes. Now, I can't remember any of them right now, but they took my phone at the show, so I have no documentation of it, which is truly problematic for me.
Yeah, it's hard for you.
But he said a bunch of really funny stuff at the show,
too. But
is
he funny? But here's my question. Is he funny and self-aware about being Mick Jagger, or is he just a funny guy? Does he understand the fundamental comedy of being a 70-something-year-old, truly golden bachelor, leading like a sexually charged rock band at this particular cultural moment? Do they make reference to that?
Not explicitly, but I really deeply do feel that he understands the humor of that. And it's truly a shame that no one has had that conversation with him, because that is something I would love to hear him on.
Mick Jagger, come on podcast.
Well, you're on deck for the next interview now with the Stones. I will break the news to John Perellis. John Perellis, I apologize. But I think that's a really interesting question. John did a great interview with them this year about this album they made, Hackney Diamonds, which I have to say, pretty good album, just missed my top 20. It's not bad. And they performed at Racket with Lady Gaga. And it was wild stuff. It was a scene. It was really, there is a video of it. I think it's on YouTube. It was insane. They were going throat to throat, vocal cord to vocal cord, like in each other's faces. It was a spectacle. I was there with Lindsay Zolads, who, when Gaga came out, she grabbed my shoulder in such an intense manner, I thought I was going to lose feeling in a nerve because she knew what was about to happen. And then it did happen. You don't get to see that kind of thing every day. And it really, that was thrilling on my list of thrilling things I saw this year.
Gaga, a special artist to you. Madonna, a special artist to you. Can you talk a little bit about your mental and emotional preparation going into shows that are at that level of artist for you? Because I try for myself not to go in with any expectation, no matter how much I like or even dislike the artist that who's performing. I try to go in as blank slate as possible, especially if I'm there on company time, you know, if I'm there for labor. But you see a lot of shows for pleasure. I know that there's a lot of buildup just because I know you well. Can you talk a little bit about the buildup to, I mean, I know you saw Madonna a couple times this year. You wrote about her once. Talk about the buildup.
Well, I don't want to be disappointed, John, but unfortunately,
you want me to just read the texts between us? If you want to not answer, I'll just read all the texts.
No, the Madonna thing, this is a very special case. I have no idea if the podcast listeners are still even listening at this point. They were saying, wow, Karen's had a really
listening
to her talk about her
they're
year.
Listening. Our completion rate's really good.
I hope I'm not demolishing it with this episode. I apologize, everybody. I was under exceptional duress because I assigned myself, so I have no one to blame but myself.
That's true.
the Madonna review because I knew that John Perales was not going to be able to be there this time. And I felt that as much as you were completely capable.
You needed to.
Well, I believe in you and I believe in Lindsay both very much, but I have seen every Madonna arena tour since the turn of the millennium. And I felt like perhaps I was best educationally positioned.
Mm-hmm.
The problem for me and anybody who enjoyed and recalls our 60 times Madonna changed the culture feature that we did 5 years ago when she turned 60, Madonna has set every bar in pop music exceptionally high. Her standards are very high. And how long can one meet those standards is a question. And I did not want it to be a sexist question because when she announced her tour and there were like 50 hot takes about, oh, Madonna at 60 something is going to be back on the road. That's wildly offensive. The Stones, as previously noted, are on the road in their 80s. Why would it be a thing that she's on the road? Well, you could say because she performs a pop spectacle in a different manner than they perform a rock show.
Sure.
So, okay, fine. I will grant you that. But I know that Madonna has been up against things that are perhaps beyond her control, i.e. the passage of time. It comes for us all. She had been injured following she wrapped up Madame X, which was a theater cabaret experience in 2020, and she had both hip and knee surgery. Then right when she was going to get on the road last summer, she had a bacterial infection and was in the hospital. There were ailments and there were issues and there were circumstances that were presenting me for the first time as seeing Madonna in an arena with the possibility that the bar might have had to have been lowered for this tour. And I was very stressed out about the idea of having to write about this tour in a way that had to account for that, to be honest with you, because I am used to writing about Madonna at her peak.
Madonna fans are maybe not exactly as rabid as the Barbs or the Navy or whatever, but Madonna fans are really about that Madonna. You don't want to be on the wrong side. I mean, Lord knows as a critic, I've been on the wrong side any number of times. But there are people for whom they are not capable of seeing a star at Madonna's level as anything other than perfect. And to have to write, should that be the case, to have to write that it's hazard pay type material.
And there are even additional circumstances. Madonna was performing a hits tour for the very first time. Madonna very famously does not like to look back. She's always forward looking. And when she would perform older songs on these past few arena tours, she would reinvent them. There would be remixes. They were not the familiar ones. So if you were just a 1987 Madonna fan showing up to hear Holiday, she wasn't going to give you the Holiday that you wanted. And I loved that about her. It was like a stubbornness. And there was just something frustrating where it was like, no, you're going to keep evolving with me. I am not going to just sit and remember the past. And now she comes to this tour where she's going to be remembering the past and she's not going to have a live band. She was going to be singing to track, which was different for her as well. She's not in her most peak physical condition. So yes, I was very stressed about this. And I will say I reviewed the tour on Wednesday and I think that I fairly represented what was happening, which was that it was Madonna, who is always Madonna, greatest of her generation, but you have to acknowledge that there were some issues with the show.
Yeah, sure.
I went back the following night for fun and I enjoyed it in a very similar manner. But then, I mean, without the shackles of knowing that I was going to get home and write about the show. By the way, she went on at 10:50 p.m. on Wednesday night. I got home at 2 a.m.
They don't talk about that. When they get mad about the review, they don't talk about the logistics of filing. But anyway.
No, I could not get an Uber home, Madonna. It was really stressful and it was cold out. And I only had my $10 from the street t-shirt to keep me warm. It was tough. Anyway, but I did go back the Saturday night. I wasn't expecting to see the show all three times. And it was like perfection.
Okay. I did not ask you this in real time, but I did think it. Do you think the show was better? Or do you think that unclenched from the responsibility of having to assess it at that level, that in essence, you could be a little bit more forgiving?
No, she was better. She was like fundamentally the best on Saturday night. It was the best of the three nights by far. I had small quibbles with a little bit of pitchiness on night one and two. She nailed all the vocals on Saturday night. And by the way, it should be noted, she's singing live pretty much the entire show. I mean, there are places where you can hear a backing track, but not really. I mean, it's impressive. People don't do that much when they're dancing that hard. Some of the choreography that I found was like a little bit imprecise or lagging on Wednesday night. All of it nailed Saturday night. There's a couple of places in the set where she pauses to speak extemporaneously with the audience. Saturday night, it was the most loose, hilarious, revealing of the three nights, I just felt like she was in a different gear that night. And it made me really happy because now I know that that bar can still be achieved. I don't think she cleared it on Wednesday, but I know that she still can. And this is not an advertisement for the Madonna tour, but I have to say, if you've never seen Madonna in an arena, I would go see this tour before the end because I know nothing. I have no inside knowledge, but it certainly smacks of farewell to the arena stage to me.
You mentioned that Madonna historically has not done a hits review.
Yes.
And I know that this is, in essence, as you said, it's Madonna's Eras Tour, this tour. There were other Eras Tours this year. And I wonder.
I don't know her.
So there were Eras Tours this year. Do you think that the choice of both of these performers to do a show like this has to do with what happened during the pandemic and having to do some kind of reset slash like reestablishment of baseline before moving forward? Could doing something like radically new and untested in the wake of 3 or 4 years of absence and uncertainty, was that less an option, do you think, for performers at this scale?
It's a good question. I mean, Beyonce didn't, notably. She toured the album that she made last year. I think with Taylor, and I know we've talked about this on podcast before, but she released like 6 albums, if you include the re-releases during the past 5 years or whatever. I think that she needed to do this. I think for her, it was the ultimate fan service, but also obviously one of the most savvy, canny marketing moves that we've seen in some time. I mean, this tour is not just a tour. It is the cultural object that ate all of 2023. It's like nothing else existed.
That is true.
For Madonna, I mean, I think it does have something to do with just age and reflection. She was celebrating the 40th anniversary of her career over the past year or so. She put out a bunch of remixes and 12-inch stuff that people had been clamoring for years and years. She doesn't have a new album to promote. I think for her, I think, yes, for similar but not identical reasons that she did, this was the right tour for her at this moment.
It made me think the fact that they both took that approach, obviously, I do think there's different underlying reasons, but it does feel to me like they were solving a similar problem, which is everybody was thoroughly decontextualized for like a year or two, and to emerge fully reformed as a new thing without acknowledging slash paying homage to the past feels a little bit dicey right now. And it's funny because I agree, Renaissance Tour, which now I've seen in the filmic version, which I unfortunately was not able to see IRL, but Renaissance Tour is not an Eras Tour in the classic sense that Taylor and Madonna did, but it is nostalgia heavy. It is referencing older modes of Black dance music and also older modes of Beyonce, even if it's not directly a kind of like, here's what I was doing in 98, here's what I was doing in 02, here's what I was doing in 06. So I think there was some of that sprinkled in as well. Although I will say that of all of these artists, the one who I think has the most license to just show up and do whatever the hell they want to do is Beyonce.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Madonna.
No, sorry. I think it's regrettably for you, the answer, I believe, is Beyonce. And so I think I'm not surprised that of the three, she didn't choose that route explicitly. But I do think that it trickled in to the set list for sure.
I think it did. But she, to me, carried the most heavy spirit of the old Madonna tours with her.
Beyonce.
Which was, yes, I will continue to innovate, even if this was like a reflexive innovation. This was very different for Beyonce. I've seen all of her tours and I'd never seen her do anything like that before. It was like conceptual in a grand scale, and it didn't always hold together as concept, but I think seeing the movie was illuminating and I understood more of her thinking behind just assembling it as an object. I love that tour so much. I'm sorry you didn't see it in person.
Yeah,
it did
too.
Cost me $975 for my ticket, but it was worth every penny.
Karen will be starting a GoFundMe after this episode. If you would like to contribute to her American Express bill for having paid for 3 Renaissance Tour tickets.
I was reminiscing about how I bought $5,000 worth of Madonna tickets. And I think I said it on podcast that my mom texted me and she said $5,000 of Madonna tickets? ?
Yeah, that's the real, it's not Travis. Karen on Madonna tickets is the real sicko mode. That's 100%. Okay, before we go, you also see a lot of small shows. I know that you saw Jinx and Dela recently. There's Judy.
They're not small, John Caramonica.
No, smaller. Sorry.
Okay, all right.
Judy Collins is on your list.
I love Judy Collins.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that side of your live year.
I do try to see older artists as much as possible, just because they're living history. And you just don't know how long you're going to be able to see them as perfect as they are. Judy Collins, absolutely still exquisite. Insanely in sync, so sharp, such an incredible performer. And she was performing with a gospel choir. Now I can't remember all the terms of this, but she was performing at Town Hall, which is a historic venue. And I think that she was like recreating a show that she had done there perhaps 50 years prior. I hope I'm not butchering this too much. I apologize, Judy. That was remarkable. So, so, so good. Also, I really have to talk about Feist's live show for even just one second. Her album Multitudes, I don't want to ruin it. It's a tour. It's a tour that you can ruin. It's a tour with a spoiler alert. It has like a theatrical conceit. And I have to say, you have to go into that show with an open heart. I had absolutely no idea what was about to happen. And I was so thoroughly tricked. Okay, I'm wildly tempted to describe the show, but I really don't want to ruin it. It's just, I will say, when her album Multitudes came out, I didn't completely click with it immediately. And as soon as I started seeing her perform these songs at the show, it was just like a mind-expanding experience. It was so gorgeous and so moving. And she really has a gift for bringing her stuff to the stage. I think she's doing a couple of more dates before she wraps Multitudes, like strong, urge everybody to see it. It's something that you're going to want to talk about the next day. Shockingly good.
Of this list, is there one show that is the clear standout? The number one, the absolute.
I mean, that might be it. Feist might be number one for the year. It was like stunning. I really like, I laughed, I cried kind of experience, visually engaging the entire show. There's just things happening on video that will confuse you and dazzle you. And we were talking earlier just about arena spectacle and being surprised at shows. I should have thought to bring this up at that point. This was at Brooklyn Steel. So like a 3,000, 3,500 person venue, I guess, standing. And it thrilled like a theatrical performance. It could have been an arena show. It could have been on Broadway. It just has a very magical quality to it. I was talking about the magic of Broadway with Jinx and Dela, who you brought up briefly. Two of my favorite drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race with a really fun cabaret show. And about when you see something in person like that, it's just so funny and thrilling and you can't recreate it. It doesn't matter if you watch it on streaming or on TV. You'll never feel the moment that you do shoulder to shoulder with the people in the venue, sharing the like very, in their case, exquisite, hilarious queer humor that really only works in that with the right audience and with the right people. And when everyone gets it, they get it. And you feel like, you know, it's launching you into another way of thinking. It's just so fun. But the Feist show is like that. I think that's number one. But Maren Morris at Bowery, extremely special moment. I feel like she's reclaimed who she is this year. She seemed really like more like herself. Jessie Ware, Terminal 5, so much fun. Love you, Jessie Ware. I do.
Karen, your year in live music, as always, a triumph of the form. You mentioned just a minute ago the sort of revival tours, Liz Phair and the Breeders. Pick something from one of them to go out on.
Oh, that's exciting. Okay, hang on.
Let the kids know.
Let's go out on the last song from Liz Phair's Exile in Guyville. It's Strange Loop. Perhaps an unconventional pick, but when I heard it live, I was like reminded about what a special song it is.
We'd love to hear it. This is Liz Phair, Strange Loop. We'll be back in just a sec.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. Christian nationalists are attacking these fundamental freedoms. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/NYT.
I also saw a bunch of shows this past year, as Karen and I went over a couple of them just now. But I just wanted to tell a funny story, which kind of has no other home. And it's about live performance, and it's pretty recent. So let me just talk through probably the most adventurous night out I had this year, which did not result in seeing any music live. At the Mercury Lounge a couple of weeks ago, there was a free or a RSVP show for Yabo JJ, who's part of the kind of like post Playboy Cardi rage, post rage underground. I think Xavier So Based was also on the bill, Fresh Boy Swag. I suspected it would be a little bit of a mess because the Mercury Lounge is not that big and it was a free show. And it seemed like almost maybe it was set up by design to be a little bit of a mess. So anyway, I get to the show, I'm driving, pulling past the venue looking for parking, and there's like 500 kids maybe outside congregated around the tiny entrance and lined up to the corner and around the corner. And I'm like, this is looking rough. I don't know if I'm going to get in, find some parking. I walk back and I get a couple messages from people inside who are like, can you get in? And I'm like, no. And they're like, well, we can't get out. And I'm like, that's curious. Why are you trying to get out? The show hasn't even started yet. And pretty soon it was a melee outside. People were climbing up on the fire escapes on the apartment building that's over the Mercury Lounge. The metal detector, which is outside or right at the entrance to the Mercury Lounge, was pulled out of the venue, out into the middle of the street, and jumped on and stomped and broken into pieces like a wrestling maneuvers. People were getting into scraps with each other. People were getting into scraps with some random people walking by. People were getting into scraps with people driving by in cars. It was fun. It was messy, but it was fun. It felt like some 90s energy. Needless to say, the show was canceled, did not go off as planned. And apparently later that night, it was moved to a skate park down the Lower East Side. And then there were a few minutes of music playing / performance there. If it was the me of 10 to 15 years ago, I would have stuck it out all the way to the bitter end and come home and done an epic write-up with the photos about a wild night in the Lower East Side. As it was, I got to go home early. I hope everybody who went to both of those things had a great night. And kids live streaming, there's video, there's YouTube recaps, a couple of bloggers, I think Nobel's did a write-up, a couple of bloggers did stick it out, did have a great night talking afterwards with Hakeem from Our Generation, Jason Buford, Sam was publicist for the night. We had a lot of fun chopping it up on the corner afterwards. I saw a kid who I sold like a Rick Owens coat to at the Throwing Fit sale. He was outside live streaming. Anyway, melee, a lot of fun, a little unnerving, but certainly did draw more attention to Yabo JJ than if he had just gotten on stage and performed a few songs. So that was probably my most fun live music experience in 2023. We'll go out with the Yabo JJ song. So thanks to Karen for checking in with us on the year in Gans Core and Gans Live. Before we go, I do want to thank everybody who's been on Popcast this year. We do this at the end of every year. Every time I go through the year's worth of episodes, I'm always so grateful and so excited. And frankly, surprised at how many incredible people who come to the show and talk about music, talk about things they care about. So I just want to do the honor roll of the 2023 Popcast contributors. So here, let's run down. First of all, obviously, it's our close colleagues and familiar friends. It's Karen, it's Joe Coscarelli, John Perellis, Lindsay Zolads, Ben Cesario. Also, New York Times colleagues and frequent contributors, Elena Bergeron, Amanda Hess, Marcus Moore, Wesley Morris, Gio Russinello, Brian Siebert, Mark Tracy, and then everybody from out in the rest of the world who came on and hung out with us for a week. Elamine Abdel Mahmoud, Kemi Alamoru, Andrew Barber, Zach Barron, Scott Bernstein, Tom Bryan, Jamie Brooks, Jason Buford, Layla Kobo, Justin Charity, Shad Souza, Karina Delvai-Shorska, Marcus K. Dowling, Josh Duboff, Jason P. Frank, Sadie Sartini Garner, Dylan Green, Tamar Herman, Harmony Holiday, Aria Hughes, Jeff Yaza, Verinda Jagoda, Rebecca Jennings, Foster Kamer, Kara, Elias Light, Jason Lipschitz, Amanda Marie Martinez, Marissa Moss, Keith Murphy, Joseph Patel, Questlove, y'all forgot about that one. Questlove was on earlier in the year. Yassi Salik, Kelifasane, Danielle Smith, Albert Soto, Harry Tafoya, Gia Tolentino, and Kat Zhang. Again, a hell of a year. Thanks to everybody who showed up for Popcast in 2023. Listen to every Popcast ever, all the episodes with those folks at nytimes.com/popcast. Popcast Deluxe with me and Joe is on YouTube at youtube.com/popcast. Subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio content. That is Apple, Spotify, YouTube, etc., etc. The Discord and the Facebook are active. tinyurl.com/popcast Discord or /popcast Facebook. We're back for 2024. Here's Yapo JJ. It's, I believe it's 1-0. It's spelled 1-0. Maybe it's I-O, but it's 1-0. Yapo JJ. I got my blunt and I write next to you. I wrote my blunt right up next to you. Lose control right up next to you.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.